Good morning. It's 9 minutes after 6 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell. I'll be filling in for Joy Cardine this morning. Well, this hour, we are taking a look at the issue of why wine is challenging beer's popularity. In recent years, beer sales for the major brewers are stagnant, while the market for wine has soared. One of our guests this hour will help us find out why appealing to certain lifestyles and health aspects have helped wine dominate the market. We'll also be talking to a local beer maker later in the hour about how his operation tries to appeal to the same consumer that buys wine. And if everything holds, we'll also be talking to a local winemaker later on in the hour about his take on the situation as well. We'll also be taking your calls and questions. Why do you think beer's popularity is fizzling? Or is it? If you were given a choice, would you drink beer or wine or neither or why? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from the Madison area, it is 263-1890. We're going to begin this hour by talking with Field Maloney. He is the author of a piece published in Slate.com last week called Beer in the Headlights. Sales are flat. Wine is ascendant. How did this happen? Field Maloney, good morning and welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks.
Excellent. Let's start with your piece. I don't know if a lot of our listeners had a chance to read it, but you began the piece by focusing on a beer commercial for one of the major brewers, and the kind of the payoff for the whole the commercial is a can of beer that smashes a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And you say that it represents a couple of things, and among them, it's a dream of the American brewing industry. Why don't you start there and tell us what that dream of the American brewing industry is these days?
Well, I think the American beer industry is getting alarmed because since 2000, beer sales have been flat, and wine and liquor sales are increasingly eating up beer's share of the America's alcohol consumption. So I think they're getting quite nervous. Wine, since 1996, wine consumption in this country has almost doubled, whereas beer is pretty. Has grown a little bit since 1996, but not much, and has been basically flat since 2000. So, I think that beer makers are also worried that one of the crucial demographics, which is 20 to 30 year olds, seem to be defecting to liquor and to beer. I mean, liquor into wine, and not drinking beer in the same numbers that they traditionally have.
So why was this a topic that appealed to you? I mean, were you just sort of living your life and you noticed this change, or do you have an interest in wine or beer or both?
I have an interest in both, just as someone who likes to drink the occasional beverage. And I'm writing a book about wine for Little Brown, about wine in America, and I've generally written a lot of pieces for Slate where I was interested in trying to understand how these larger cultural shifts happen, if they are indeed cultural shifts, and this seems to be to suggest something is going on here that's causing our taste, what we drink at the table, to change in a fairly big way.
I want to talk about that. I mean, what do you think? Is it really a cultural shift? In your piece, you argue that, in a sense, that beer represents, one facet of the American character, and wine at one point represented something else. Maybe now it represents something else again. Can we extrapolate all that just from what people choose to drink?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can and you can. I mean, one point I made is in the colonial era, hard cider was the dominant drink in this country, and that was because hard cider and whiskey, there was corn whiskey, which people would make on the frontier, but that was fairly hard to make, and then rum was imported from the South Indies, hard cider was the main drink because we were a rural nation then, and people had apple trees in their backyard, and And that sort of, Johnny Appleseed was basically a popularizer of cheap booze by going around planting apple trees. That was sort of the main purpose of apple trees on the frontier, was so you'd have access to a drink, but then an alcoholic drink, that is. But then around the middle of the 19th century, so like 1850s, as we started becoming more industrial, and there were more and more factories, and especially there was a big rise in German immigration into America, and the Germans immigrants were often manning the new factories that were being built around the cities and coming to the cities, and they brought a beer drinking culture. So around 1860, beer eclipsed hard cider as the most popular drink in the country. But so on the one hand, that just says, oh, here all of a sudden one drink is more popular than the other. But it reveals a deeper shift, which is that it means that by 1860 we had gone from being a predominantly rural nation, a nation of small farmers pretty much, to an urban and industrial nation. So there's often bigger forces behind that. And I think with beer and wine, it's a little trickier, and it's also important to remember that there are certain complicating factors with this trend, which is, for example, craft beer drinking mm-hmm. is rising, in double digits. But still, I would say there's some big cultural shifts here. I'd say a big one is sort of foodie culture. Everyone is becoming a connoisseur of some sort, I would say.
All right, then we're going to hold it here and take a break, and we'll return to that thought. We're talking about beer and wine. Wine has become more popular than beer in many quarters. And is it a cultural shift, or is it just a case of what people like to drink? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. Field Maloney is with us right now. He is the author of a piece published on Slate.com last week, Beer in the Headlights. Sales are flat. Wine is ascendant. How did this happen? I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 19 minutes after 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 8 o'clock, Melvin Laird is our guest, and we talk about a system of compulsory universal civil service for young people. That's up after 8 this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we are talking with Field Maloney currently. He is the author of a piece published on Slate.com last week called Beer in the Headlights, taking a look at the popularity of beer and wine in America, how that is changing, and what it all might mean. If it means anything to you, give us a call toll-free at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. 263-1890. And Field Maloney, before the break, we were talking about what shift this might mean, and you brought up the whole topic of what you call the foodie culture. And why don't you go into some more detail on that?
Well, one big thing is we're spending a lot more time thinking about food these days, and I think that 30 years ago, the amount of people who say we're concerned about getting arugula or buying organic this or buying organic that or finding out where exactly their beef came from was a very small sliver of the population. And now there's a pretty widespread interest in, say, goat cheese. You never heard of goat cheese 10 years ago. It was a pretty rare thing.
Mm-hmm. And you had to want to find it.
Yeah, you had to work to find it. And now your average grocery store, you'll see it somewhere there. And one of the things I said in this piece is that partly our sense of the good life shifted from looking to France and upper-class England for our idea of, like, fine dining and good living to down south, to the Mediterranean, and particularly to an Italian ideal of good looking, of good living, sorry. And when we were looking to France and England, I would say that the dominant principles were refinement and formality. You know, white tablecloths, you drink a grand Bordeaux wine, you eat, some very meticulous preparation of food, and the model of that might be Julia Child, you could say. And then as we shift in the 80s, we begin to shift down south to Italy and to a Mediterranean ideal, which the hallmarks are passion and spontaneity and bounty, and there's a much greater sense of informality. And I think that when there was this shift, it made foodie culture much more appealing and accessible to average Americans. I would say the Italian model of the big night, you know, the big
sure
family around the table. And I think all of a sudden things like wine, which were just an essential part of that Italian meal, and it doesn't matter whether you're a peasant family or you're Italian aristocrats, everyone has wine. That was part of that, and I think that this sort of informality really struck a chord in Americans, and it was a sort of foodie culture that they could embrace, and so they have been. And I mean, the interest in food in this country has skyrocketed in the last decade or two, and I would say that what's happened is wine has a central place in this interest in food, and the ideal of pairing food with wines, and beer hasn't in our imaginations had so much of a place. I mean, that's what I think beer marketers are trying to do, and craft brewers especially are trying to do, or to remind people that beer can be wonderful with food. But I think that it's something that beer got left behind on a bit. Whereas when you think of having a big feast, you think of having wine with it.
Well, this is a good opportunity for us to bring another voice into the conversation. Russ Klisch joins us right now. He is president of the Lakefront Brewery here in Milwaukee, and also head of the Wisconsin Brewers Guild. And we started talking about craft brewers there. And Russ Klisch, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Good to have you along. I know you're only here for a few minutes, so we'll take advantage of you while we can. I don't know how much of the story you heard there, but we were talking a little bit about sort of the rise of the food culture and how that plays into the popularity of wine and the stagnation in some of the major brewing sales. But you're a craft brewer, and you know, when you start talking about craft beers, a lot of the same terminology, a lot of the same things people say about wine start coming into play when you start talking about a smaller brewer such as yourself.
Yes, exactly. Craft beer has a lot of different flavors and styles and types, and matches well with a lot of styles of food as compared to maybe 20, 30 years ago, when you basically had kind of a one-dimensional brewing industry that you had here. But now, with so many different styles, with the hops and with the different grains and fruits, beers that our craft beers, brewers across the state brew, they match well with a lot of different foods.
Now, do you see our guest, Phil Baloney, has attributed the rise of popularity of wine in part to that, and the popularity of craft beers seems to be going up as well. And do you tie those two elements together, or are these two things happening separately in your mind?
No, I think it's a general trend across the country. You just don't see it with wine and beer, but you also see it like with coffee or bread. A lot of other food groups, or a lot of people are just trying to trade up and having more interest in eating better.
Mm-hmm. And here in Wisconsin, of course, Wisconsin has a rich brewing tradition, particularly if you think of major brewers like Schlitz, Blatz, Pabst, Miller, of course, is still here, G. Heilemann, Point, and so on and so on. But in terms of craft brewing, sales are doing pretty well. How is Lakefront doing, and to what do you attribute all that?
Craft beer across the nation in the last 3 years has been up 7, 9, and 12%. So we're one of the largest increases in the country in any type of either from spirits or wine. And so the what I attribute it to is, you know, mostly our education of trying to get people to try our different tastes and flavors of our beer. And people are finding that they enjoy them and that there's more choice out there than just the styles and types that they've been drinking in the past.
And do you feel that craft beer competes favorably with wine in terms of quality, in terms of the richness of the experience, and all of that? Because, you know, if you listen to wine connoisseurs talk, you know, it's the next best thing to heaven, practically.
Yeah, well, I feel the same way about beer, in that you know, it's the best thing. That's what I feel. It's a great drink. It's a drink in moderation. You can have it with so many different types and styles of food. There's a lot of people just I haven't been used to trying to pair food with beer. I know the a lot of cheese tastings we've gone to in the last couple years pair cheese with beer, and it's worked out very, very well.
And Field Maloney, how does what you're hearing from Rush Klisch, that is really hard for me to say, play into the thesis behind your piece?
Oh, I agree with everything he's saying. I mean, I think that wine has been taking off because of our larger American interest in food these days, and coffee and bread, and I think that for the same reasons, craft beer is taking off, and that's probably partly why people are less interested in just the same old big beers and interested in trying new smaller beers, local beers. I mean, and part of the craft beer movement, I think, is part of a increasing national interest in getting local food, and so you can get your local beer, you know, rather than getting a bottle of Bud, you get a bottle of Lakefront, or you get a bottle of, you know, I'm here in New York, so it would be Brooklyn Brewery, but that people are trying to buy local foods, and that would include beer and wine to a certain extent. And
Russ Klisch, before we let you go, is that what you're seeing in Milwaukee, that people do like the local aspect, that they like the different taste, and it does something like compare favorably against a major brewer?
Sure. The local aspect is very big with breweries. It's always fun to root for the local guy and some place that you can go down and actually see them where they make the product that takes kind of the mystery out of it. And, you know, rooting for the local brewery is kind of like rooting for your local sports team. Everybody wants to be behind it locally, and local food movements are great across the country.
Russ Klisch, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Russ Klisch, the president of the Lakefront Brewery in Milwaukee and also of the Wisconsin Brewers Guild. We're talking about beer and wine this hour. Wine sales are up. Beer is flat. Why is that? We'll continue the discussion after this break in the news here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 25 minutes before 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine this morning. This hour, we are talking about beer and wine sales in the United States. Our guest during the whole hour is Field Maloney. He is the author of a piece on Slate.com. It was published last week, called Beer in the Headlights. Sales are flat, wine is ascendant. How did this happen? We're talking about some of his theories and taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. We do have a couple of callers who would like to join, so let's go right to the phones. And Sue joins us now from Bayside. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to chime in and say that just like I buy better quality coffee, I want to buy better quality beer as well. And I find that in the microbrews. In fact, my husband recently has gotten into brewing his beer at home.
Mm-hmm.
And when you compare that to the commercially made beers, there's just such a difference. I'd also like to be giving my business dollars to local breweries and small businesses, you know, in the area rather than the commercial breweries. And the other point is that as a woman, I stopped buying commercial beers years ago because of their advertising campaigns. They were, you know, they would objectify women, and they were very degrading. So they lost my sales years ago.
All right, Sue, thanks for the call, and let's get some comments from Field Maloney on that. A couple of things there to talk about. And first of all, in the first part of Sue's comments, we heard exactly what we've been talking about for the past few minutes, and that is people are after the quality and after the local nature of beer or wine these days.
Yep.
And the advertising thing is not something that we have spoken of, and here's one consumer who says that the advertising turned her off, as you watch advertising, particularly for large beer companies these days, they're trying anything to get our attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very, very interesting point. One of the things about the big beer makers who are pumping most of the money into beer advertising is their demographic is largely male, and they've to a certain extent perpetuated it by having a very male kind of advertising, sort of Spuds McKenzie party dog and mm-hmm. bikini ladies. And I think that beer, now what you see is you see an interesting mix of beer ads where you see the more traditional sort of party boy with, and there is often a vaguely... sexist might be too strong a word, but objectifying attitude to women in those ads. But then you also see ads that are more emphasizing the heritage of beer making and beer as something that you know complements like a nice meal with friends and whatnot. But I think that's going to be a big challenge for beer makers right now is to get women drinking beer, and I think that's always been a challenge for them. But now, especially, and I think that both wine and the wine and liquor industry have not had that problem, and both wine and liquor have a large part of their audience is women as well as men. And I mean, I think one of the interesting things for me about all this is thinking about how sometime, I'm not quite sure when, and I'd be interested in what readers or listeners think, but somehow beer or wine became macho, or at least not unmanly. Macho is probably too strong, but and I noticed it very clearly last year when I was watching a football game, and there was an ad for cell phones, but it featured a guy walking around a winery, a winemaker, and he was sort of a rugged dude dusting off bottles of wine in the cellar and walking through his vineyards. And it was clear that this was supposed to be a guy that you were supposed to look up to or like, rather than, I feel like 10 years before that, if you had anything to do with wine during a commercial for an NFL playoff football game, you'd be sort of making fun of the wine drinker as sort of prissy or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of I don't quite know why that happened, but so I think, but somehow it did, and it's sort of interesting to me.
And I have an example of that that I'm going to play on the a little piece of audio that we have here, and this is from the movie Sideways that would. Two guys, I think, going through the vineyards of Northern California, and one is trying to teach the other one about wine.
Stick your nose in it. Don't be shy. Really get your nose right in there, really. Mm. A little citrus. Maybe some strawberry. Mm. Passion fruit.
Mm.
And, oh, there's just like the faintest sousson of like asparagus, and there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
Wow.
Mmm.
Strawberries, yeah.
Good.
Strawberries.
Yeah.
Not the cheese.
And there, Field Maloney, they're sort of making fun of that. But it, at the same point, it kind of reinforces your point that all of a sudden it's okay for people to talk about things like asparagus in your wine.
Yeah, yeah. And as the brewer who was coming, who came on earlier, said, I mean, even now people are starting to do that with beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Sideways did partly was, The main character is there's something likable about him, but there's something also pathetic about him, and he's sort of the total wine nerd so I think the movie both is sort of making fun of wine culture and sending it up, but it also is embracing it or celebrating. You know, the pleasures of wine. So I think that stuff like that has made wine less of a sort of scary big deal and more something that people can enjoy without feeling intimidated by. And that was sort of a big step for wine marketers, I think, was trying to figure out a way for Americans to suddenly think of wine as an everyday drink rather than a stuffy, formal occasion, sort of foreign drink that they would drink, but they it wasn't a natural thing for them.
And one of the things you talked about in your piece, kind of tying in with all the marketing of it, in some senses, it's been easier for winemakers to advertise. We talked about the trouble with the beer makers, or the major ones anyway, are having trying to sort of find their niche and decide who their audience is and so forth. And with wine, a lot of times, they just sort of stick a bottle in the middle of the table, put some sun in the background and a family standing around it, and you've got your ad campaign.
Yeah, and I think that's part of wine's appeal right now is I call it pastoral chic, but there's I think right now we're and partly it's happening at, because we're losing our farmland and we're losing our countryside, or most of us at least don't live in countryside or farmland anymore, and so all of a sudden the idea of a hill full of vines, full of green vines and grapes growing is a very powerful resonant idea, and winemakers play up that, you know, very well. And I mean, one of the funny things is that you can have winemakers who are making wine at oil refinery volume, but they're still able to trade upon this very bucolic idea of, you know, some guy, you know, stamping grapes barefoot, you know, in the hills of Tuscany, when in fact it looks more like a, you know, a giant oil plant, but it's still a very powerful marketing tool, and beer doesn't have that because beer is more of is less of an agricultural product, and it's more of the product of a process of manufacture.
Let's go to a quick call here from Lee, who joins us from New Glarus. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Am I coming through?
Yeah, you're on just fine.
Okay, yeah, I'm calling from New Glarus, Wisconsin, home of Spotted Cow, and which is a great local Wisconsin beer, and they only ship it in Wisconsin. And I kind of want to agree to disagree that, you know, I think there's really a place for beer as a sophisticated drink that kind of defines itself. Out here, we have this wonderful little brewery that's about the size of two small houses stuck together, an 80-year-old copper brew kettle, and they just make a really, really great set of beers. They make about 9 or 10 a year, different varieties. And unfortunately, their most popular one, Spotted Cow, has become so popular that they've had to build a larger brewery outside of town, just outside of town, to accommodate all of the demand. But on the bright side, we have this wonderful little copper brew house yet, and the two owners are actually using that as sort of a I want to say, laboratory for making all these wonderful fruit beers and varieties and really great experimentations that, you know, thankfully, because I live in the town, I really kind of get to enjoy the fruits of. But I would say it's sort of a return back to that real organic kind of pastoral experience you talked about, where they make beers unplugged over here. They put in barley, they put in fruit, they put in whatever they have around and make a really great variety.
Lee, thanks for the call. I'm afraid we got to take a break here, but I do appreciate... No, it's no problem. We appreciate your call. And Phil Maloney will be back. We've got to take a break, as I say, and we'll continue our discussion now about sales of beer, sales of wine, and how everything all fits together. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 12 minutes before 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week. We're talking about an article written by Field Maloney, who's been joining us for the past 45 minutes or so, published on Slate.com last week, called Beer in the Headlights, Sales Are Flat, Wine is Ascendant, and How Did This Happen? Earlier in the program, we spoke with a craft brewer from Milwaukee, and now we turn to a whole different kind of manufacturer here in Wisconsin. A local winemaker joins us right now, Philippe Cacard, who is a winemaker with a Wollersheim Winery in Prairie du Sac, celebrating its 35th anniversary. And good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio. And we've been talking about wine and beer and why some beer sales are flat, craft beer sales are up. And how is wine doing here in Wisconsin, Philippe Cacard?
Wine is doing tremendously well, tremendously good. Just to put it in a nutshell, 10 years ago, Wisconsin had a dozen wineries, and today I think we are up to 35 wineries. And all the states surrounding Wisconsin are feeling the same impact. Iowa could be up to 150 wineries, Illinois the same way, Minnesota around 30 as well. So it's wine is booming throughout America.
Now, and why do you think that is? I mean, who was drinking wine 20 years ago, and who is drinking it now? Are they the same people, or is it a whole shift in the population who's been drinking wine?
It's interesting. When I came on board in Wisconsin about 23 years ago, I thought the wine drinkers were all 50s and 60s and 70 years old, and it was a scary thought, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just where is the new generation? And I think, you know, reading the article and the Julia Child generation, which introduced wine and food, wine as a pairing with food, wine going with the meal, and so on, all those kids saw that it was acceptable. It is an okay thing to do. It is a good thing to do. It's part of a lifestyle. It might brighten the meal. And those kids are now in their late mid-20s and 30s. And every day at the winery, every weekend, we see that young generation coming to buy cases of wine. And being the Pinot Grigio, the Riesling, the Cab, the estate grown like our Domaine du Sec, or so there's a genuine interest in American wine, local wines, what's grown in your backyard.
And Field Maloney, it sounds like your thesis, at least in part, is being born out here in Wisconsin.
Oh yeah, and it's exciting, and I think there's actually a way. I mean, what's most exciting for me about this movement is actually putting together what Philippe was saying with the caller before, which is that I think that there's a tremendous amount of interest in local, generally across the country, and it sounds like in Wisconsin too, local beer, local wine, finding what's being made and grown in your backyard.
And I have to say, when you're talking, whether you're talking about the brewery in New Glarus or the winery in Prairie du Sac, they are pretty bucolic settings. I mean, it's a pretty place to be, and it does put you in a different frame of mind.
Mm-hmm. It's, and you know, just as I mean, no, we always say numbers speak for themselves, but in the span of 25 years, we went from 35,000 bottles to over 1.2 million bottles.
That's pretty substantial.
Yeah.
And the question I have to ask is, you know, you talked about the younger consumers coming in, Philippe. Are you seeing more sophisticated palates walking through the door as well, as opposed to what you might have seen 20 or 25 years ago? Or are you seeing the same level of sophistication, just more of them?
I think, you know, everybody wants to be sophisticated.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just like that is something we stress, is just go with what you like. You know, I'm the first one to say you don't have to worship that bottle of wine. It's meant to be enjoyed. And so I don't think the level of knowledge on a customer point of view has risen tremendously. But the wineries and the winemakers have played into that. We are educating the customer how to taste wine, how to age wine, what's the difference between a Pinot and a Cab. And you can go into so much depth, the age of the vine, the steepness of the slope, the kind of soil. So we are always, always educating the customer. So we are seeing, I would say, a little bit more of education. Not much, I would not say sophisticated, but well-educated, asking a lot of questions, where it's grown, how it's grown, who is involved in it, and all that stuff. And we are seeing more of them.
But at the same time, you don't encourage them to get too caught up in the technical details and forget to enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we have wines. Sometimes I cringe when I see new winery setting the price at 25 and 27 and 28. That is just not wise. And to me, wine is a beverage. So you could have it before the meal, with the appetizer, with the first course, with the entree, with the dessert, after dinner. There's a place for wine all the time at every step of the meal. And at $6 a bottle, at $8, at $10, it's all good wine.
Go ahead.
And I just want to amplify what Philippe is saying. I think part of it is that we've gotten over wine being sophisticated. We're no longer, I think that was part of the hurdle for Americans getting into wine, was that it was something that was sophisticated and that was daunting. And now I think that it's become more just an everyday pleasure. And ironically, what we're doing is we're moving closer to the way it's always been in, say, Europe, where wine is not this big, sophisticated, fancy thing. It's what you drink with your food, you know, mm-hmm. whether you're the wealthiest man in the world or just, a poor farmer in the country. And so I think that we're becoming more that way. And then the other thing I wanted to say about Philippe talking about the growth in wineries is you've had across the country a tremendous growth like that, in that in 1970 there were six states had wineries. Now all 50 states have wineries. So
yeah,
That's a tremendous change.
Go ahead, Philippe. It sounded like you were going
to
say something.
Yeah, I would just to take on field, Molin was saying, wine at any price throughout the day or at any occasion of a meal, you might want to keep that fancy $25, $30 bottle for a fancy meal, but there's no reason to not have a six or seven or $8 bottle on a Monday evening, on a Tuesday night. There is room for inexpensive wine every day.
Well, Philippe Cocard, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
Philippe Cocard, a winemaker for Wollersheim Winery in Prairie du Sac. And they are currently, by the way, celebrating their 35th anniversary. Field Maloney, before we let you go, you talked about the evolution beer, the evolution of wine, and sort of the reflection on society, you know, from a rural sort of agrarian society to a more urban industrial one. Any predictions on where we're going to be going next?
Oh, I think, and just from what we've heard in the calling, I think all signs look good. I think we're going to have better beer and better wine and more local beer and more local wine, which I think is a good thing. The more our food and drink comes from close to home, I think the better off we are in all sorts of ways. And I just want to throw in, by the way, a brief side note, which is that Philippe's winery at Prairie du Sac is actually the winery where a guy named Augustin Horasti, who is the father of winemaking in America, first landed. He was a Hungarian immigrant who started a farm in Wisconsin. So,
well, that's right. You're writing a book on wine, aren't you?
Right.
Okay, it's all
kind of
coming back.
That's where the sort of father of it all in this country came through.
Well, Field Maloney, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Field Maloney, author of the article we've been talking about and the forthcoming book on wine called Crush, and that'll be published in 2009. The Hour was produced by Leo Duran, on-air production from Christina Taylor, and I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.